Everybody, Ryan Balogi here with Pete Weber. Welcome back to Gear Effects. We are happy to have you with us after a couple-week break. We are right ready for the prime of the golf season. We are here at PGA Championship Week. Kiawah Island is on the dock, and we will talk about some of the effects of golf playing on Kiawah Island, in particular the wind. But you know, the hallmark of this week's episode is to talk about fitting so that you are a little bit better of a flusher than you were before you got fit. Pete and I kind of bandied about ideas before we got into this episode of what we wanted to talk about going into this week. And one of the initial ideas that he came up with was just kind of jumped out of the page at me, especially this week, which is basically trying to use fitting to move the strike location on your shots, on anyone's shots for that matter. Not everyone is a flusher. Not everyone is PGA Tour, LPGA Tour, European Tour caliber of a player. And even those players don't flush it every time. If you've ever heard, I'll start out with this comment and then you can kind of lead into it, Pete, a little bit. But I remember a video from Dustin Johnson at a TaylorMade event, I want to say like 4 or 5 years ago. And they asked him in kind of this roundtable discussion about how often he flushes the ball, how often he hits a perfect shot or what he considers to be a perfect shot on the club face in a round. He says, if he's lucky, twice. So obviously his standard's a little bit different than a normal person, but when most people come into a fitting, what are you looking for in terms of the quality of the position of their ball strikes?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple little things. And it's funny, I guess I hadn't even heard about that video of Dustin, but I remember hearing the old story about Ben Hogan, you know, just to tie into that. You know, he talked about maybe 4 shots a tournament that he felt were absolutely, you know, perfectly in flush. So that, I think, obviously kind of goes right in line with that. You know, as far as what I'm seeing from people, you know, like when I'm approaching a fitting on things, I want to see, you know, okay, kind of gets back to what we've talked about before. I want to see, okay, what's their average strike location look like? And how consistent are they, you know, in that same spot? You know, is it more of all that, you know, they're right on top of each other, or is there some spread? Yeah, like to your point, like the interesting thing, and you know, I've told a couple people this. It's like, you know, PGA Tour pro, you know, and a scratch handicap. As far as like a lot of what the numbers I see on TrackMan, you know, there's more similarities there as far as like quality of strike and consistency of strike. Yes, obviously tour pros can perform at, you know, these levels beyond a lot of average golfers, or really kind of the rest of us mere mortals. But they hit it. They can miss it off center just as much as anybody. We've seen that. And it's just one of those things again, when they take, you know, when I'm fitting somebody, I am looking at the good shots, but I'm looking at what's happening on the quote unquote bad shots and trying to say, okay, can we minimize damage on things? And so through PGA Tour pros fittings and their equipment, and then also just their ability to recognize patterns within their game to apply that to a strategy, I think that's a big separation point for them. You know, they can understand what their dispersion pattern is, whether they're like conscious of it or not. You know, like some of them will be like, well, they're tracking it. Some of them will just kind of, I don't know, use their spidey sense and get it or you know, figure out what it is. You know, when I'm looking at things, I'm wanting to see, okay, what are the averages? How consistent are they? Is there something that's maybe jumping out at me saying like we can move this a little bit? So I've got a couple different things that I've been able to be successful with. As far as like to give an example, I had a guy in here last week. This could be like a fairly good example. He had a 70 gram stiff shaft in his driver. It was a ping. I think he had G400 on the head. But, when we looked at it, he was averaging 6 millimeters toward the heel, 6 millimeters toward the bottom. So he was getting some spin rates and some ball speeds, maybe a little bit up of where we wanted to see things. And you know, the ball was, you know, averaging, just kind of staying out to the right. He had a draw bias pattern. I mean, his path was a couple degrees inside out. Trying to swing it to hit a draw, but his contact point was just keeping the ball out to right field. And occasionally he'd get one that would be way out there. And so as we kind of worked through things, I kind of, I had my suspicion about where I wanted to be based on his club head speed. And we really kind of found like, hey, we wanted to try some 60 gram options and see how that worked with different things. So the way I kind of go through my process with my driver fittings is, once I get a baseline of what they're doing with their current club, I'll grab, I'm going to kind of get the shaft profile that I think we're going to be in and get started with an option. And then I'm going to grab one head from each of the manufacturers that we have. So Titleist, TaylorMade, Callaway, Ping, and have them try a couple balls with each head on the same shaft. Because what I've found is like, because they all vary in their belief of head weight.
Right.
The weight of the head. So Callaway's on the lighter end. Titleist is a little bit heavier than Callaway. TaylorMade's a little bit heavier than Titleist. Ping's a little bit heavier than TaylorMade. What I've found is that people just hit a certain head weight range more consistent. So they'll find a similar spot more often with a certain head weight. But now that spot might not be in the ideal location yet, but they're going to kind of do it the same way every time. I found that's kind of held up fairly well. Once I kind of finally figure that out, figure out the head weight they hit really well, then we start maybe trying some other things. And I know like you can take different heads and make them different weights. And I think to me, I think there's a certain limit to some of that, because if you start messing with the weight of the head a little bit too much, you start, I think, messing with some of the design principles of what the engineers that made that club around. So you start to have some trade-offs if you start going, I think, too much away from the way they're supposed to be designed. So long story short with this gentleman, we found that, hey, if he needed something a little bit lighter than the ping head he had. But he hit Titleist really well, but he actually really started to light things up when I added just a couple gram weights ahead of weight to the Titleist head, got him into a better range. He started to really kind of hit it, you know, in the same spot, way more consistent. And then we actually went to a little bit lighter gram weight shaft. Because one of the ways I look at things is if all things remain the same, when a shaft is deflecting, drooping, and twisting at impact, all things remain the same. If you decrease the gram weight of a shaft, you can increase how much it droops. I don't have a club here, but the center of the face actually will come back in a little bit for the player. And so that can take the person from the heel to the center, or closer to the center, at least. And you know, just conversely, if I've got someone who's whacking it off the toe, sometimes I'll throw something heavier in their hand and it'll droop less and they can get a little bit more off the middle. And that's really what we kind of found. So there's actually two elements to this player. He also had a kind of a mid-launch shaft in his driver. So we saw the strike point was a little low on the face. So the way, a golf shaft in deflection, you know, I'm going to try to do it with my finger here, deflects, so it's a little bit more like this, you know, on a mid-launch shaft versus this with a low-launch shaft. So effectively, you know, it's helped to present a little bit lower loft. But it's also, you know, this part's longer when it's not deflecting as much. So it may only be a couple millimeters, but a couple millimeters can be one or two dimples. I mean, one or two dimples is about 5 to 10 millimeters of difference. So I've had some success with that as well as, hey, let's lower the launch profile of the shaft. Makes it kind of effectively play longer at impact, and we can pull their strike point off the bottom of the club and work it a little bit more toward the middle. So in this case, this gentleman, we had kind of the best of both worlds with that. So we were able to move him off the heel, move him a little bit more centered by going lighter in gram weight and a lower launch profile, even though he didn't launch it lower. It was just a strategy to try to get him a little bit higher on the club face.
So when you're trying to pull these levers, particularly on shafts, what lever does weight do versus shaft stiffness, recognizing that's not a universal standard,
mm-hmm.
versus torque versus launch?
Yeah. So on the first point about that, on the weight, one of the things that, you know, for in the fitting side of things that some of this can be a little bit more difficult for maybe like some people that are just working out of a fitting cart, is that like in this case, we needed to go down. In general, the gram weight of a shaft is going to help determine how stiff it can be built. Also, the bend profile is going to play into that. You know, there's a couple things into that. But, you know, like in this case, we needed to still keep the stiffness up even though we were going down gram weight. So being able to have something that you could go lighter with and still keep the stiffness up is kind of what is a very key component to it. Because even if we just, if all we do is go down in gram weight and that ends up kind of going down in playing stiffness, yeah, we might get his contact point a little bit better, but maybe we start to, you know, because it's maybe not stiff enough, his directional control is going to start to maybe suffer a little bit. So kind of want to balance everything out a little bit is, okay, if I can maintain playing stiffness in the right range for that player and go a little bit lighter gram weight to get the contact point we want, that's a big part of it. So, that's a good point. Now, as far as, you know, like, the torque side of things, you know, torque has a couple different things that it does for the player. It's a big feel thing. You know, a shaft can feel a really low torque or a tight shaft. Even if you frequency them out as the same as another shaft, that torque can make it feel stiffer for the player. Or a looser torque or a higher torque can make the club feel softer, even though the playing stiffness is, you know, playing frequency. Is where it needs to be at. One of the things I do in mine, in my approach to things is I actually use torque to kind of really, what I have found is that when you have the ideal torque for the player, the first ball they hit, usually the starting direction is kind of where we want it to be at. Contact point is good. So once I've kind of cleared up contact point, heel to toe, top to bottom, I'm going to start messing around with similar launch profiles and weights, but different torques to say, okay, what does this feel like to this player? And does it feel like something they can start the ball online with? It's something that's actually worked out as I started to kind of dabble this, like probably my first 30 or 40 customers that I was doing this with. I didn't tell them I was doing this, but I was just trying to gather some, you know, some guidance on the back end when I go back in and look at things to say, okay, these are some trends that I'm seeing kind of happen. So, you know, what I've kind of found is if you have the ideal torque, it starts online and, you know, it starts on the line they want it to. If it's too loose, I've seen some trends where same contact point on the club face all starts right and goes right. If it's too tight, same contact point on the club face starts left, goes left. And that's first ball. And then, you know, in the case where someone it's too loose and it starts right and goes right, by the third ball, it's like off the golf course left, because now they're trying to twist on the handle even more to try to get it online. So those are some trends that I've seen on trying to manage torque for that. There's a couple other, you know, ways I've kind of gone about looking at things. You know, the one I've had a lot of fun with, and I've had some success with it. It was really kind of eye-opening to me the first couple times we were able to kind of figure it out, is I have had a handful of players where, let's say their attack angle is level to maybe 1 or 2 degrees down. And you see them just kind of, you know, so not significantly down, but just slightly to maybe level. But you see contact point, and so maybe they're using like a lower launch shaft and a 10-degree loft head, because the 10-degree loft head helps them get it up in the air. But you see they're keeping their spin rates in a range that we want to see. But contact point is kind of showing a little high on the club face. So all of a sudden, ball speed starts to suffer, and the smash factor starts to suffer. So you're seeing launch and spin like, oh, it's great, 10, 2200, whatever, you know, people like that. But you stare at that ball speed and that smash factor like, man, they're losing some on that. But one of the things I've been able to do in those cases, again, trying to keep in mind the idea about how a shaft that's not deflecting as much, or a shaft that deflects more, is actually shorter, is taking one of those mid-launch profiles that effectively at impact might be actually a little bit shorter because of how it's bending, and go into a stronger loft on the driver that lowers their contact point in the middle of the club face. They keep the spin rate and the launch angle that they had, but their ball speed all of a sudden jumps up quite a bit. That's one with those players that are maybe a little level to a little to slightly down has worked out really well, actually. Again, trying to manage where that strike point, you know, happens.
For golfers who have maybe not come in and been fit previously, do they kind of have a preconceived notion about what a shaft is supposed to do for them, about flex, weight? I mean, do they have any concept really of what you just walked through, even half of it? Because, I mean, even half of what you just walked me through is like kind of mind blowing stuff.
Yeah, you know, I'd say I've got I'll get a couple that do, but you know, it's one of the things about being able to quantify a lot of it. You know, some people can sit there and look at their ball flight and say, well, you know, this shaft should be able to do this for me. And then when I start to show them the data about, okay, hey, here's your launch angle, your spin rate, your landing angle, how is it being created? Is it being created off of a fairly centered strike, or is it being created off of a not fairly centered strike? And just how working our way into it, you know, we can start to see some benefit off it. As far as the classes I just talked about there, not a ton of people kind of come in maybe with that kind of notion or maybe thinking along those lines. It's a fun conversation to have and to start to show them how that can start to change. But just being able to kind of, okay, we're out here, you know, showing you the ball flight and looking at things, it really does start to register with them after a little while, and we can start to see, start to see some different results with it. So yeah, not a ton of people are coming in understand or haven't heard anything about that. They just automatically think, they think they're hitting the ball too high, so they go to a lower launching head or a lower launching shaft. And yeah, okay, maybe they, because they want to be able to have, less spin on the golf ball and everything. And okay, yeah, it's, coming off less spin, but you're also hitting it two or three dimples high on the face. It'd be a bad thing, sacrificing a lot of ball speed.
So there's a lot of, it seems like there are three or four different ways to get to answering certain problems. But again, for every lever that you pull, you have to go the opposite way with another. It doesn't seem like there's just one thing to do and then nothing else changes. Everything changes.
Yeah. So that's where if you're, if someone's launch angle and spin rate are in a good spot, if you're going to change launch profile at shaft, you're going to have to change loft. Because that if you want to maintain that launch and spin but increase ball speed, you're going to have to change loft. And so that, that there has to be, very rarely have I had, a lot of people where we've just changed one thing and only one thing has changed result wise. it just doesn't really happen. And then there's just some things that you sit there and think about it. Like, okay, you would sit there and look at certain players and think they have to, and you see their initial results and you're like, this has to work. And, I had one, he's now on the PGA Tour. I'm not gonna mention names, but he's on the PGA Tour now. I got a hold of him when he was still on the, back then it was the web tour. When he first came to see me and we worked on some things and, just a ton of speed, and look at his TrackMan numbers and they weren't bad. He thought maybe he'd like to bring the flight down a little bit more. And so he was using kind of a mid launch Mitsubishi Diamana, blue board shaft, and, kind of looking at things. And so we try a whiteboard, and so whiteboard versus blue board. Whiteboard's supposed to be lower launch, lower spin. Excuse me. Well, he spun this one off the same spot in the club face. He literally spun it like 800 RPMs more with it. it just wasn't a profile that matched with how he transitioned and released the golf club very well. So he would kind of toss it down at the bottom because something wasn't behaving well with him. So those are always the interesting ones to me, where like maybe common thought process and of how to do things might need to be altered a little bit, or you know, someone's going to disprove you on some things. So I try to, you know, again, sit there and try to think about what maybe I thought might affect that. Now this player, this player didn't have a really long backswing. It was kind of a short, not really like up tempo, but made a huge shoulder turn. Arms didn't swing a whole lot. sorry, got a little water, a little bug down the wrong throat, wrong pipe. But, I had a similar success a couple months after that with somebody who maybe didn't have as much of an arm swing, you know, big shoulder turn. And we went kind of down the same road. We found like, hey, a mid-launch shaft really worked well for that player. They hit it pretty consistent. I gave a presentation to the Georgia PGA section. They had a little education event. Bill Hassel had one here last week here in Cartersville over at Scott Hamilton's indoor studio. And I'm not the first person to say this, but you can have your general fitting principles and philosophies and ideas about things. They're going to apply about 80 or 70% of the time. And then 30%, you're going to have to kind of get creative on things. Sorry.
That's all right. You're good. The thing I wanted to ask based on what your example there is, do some players, whether they're PGA Tour caliber or not, will they try to manipulate the club or once through the fitting process to almost kind of try to recreate what they came in with or to get to a certain result? One way or the other, are they trying to – not self-sabotage, that's not what I think they're doing, but are they kind of gaming the process a little bit?
I've had that happen with a couple players. Honestly, I would sit there and say it's probably more likely to happen with the better the player you got, just because they're used to seeing ball flights and windows. Mm-hmm. And so if we see like, okay, you know, here's a, okay, we look at your launch, your spin, your ball speed, smash factor and those things, like, okay, something's got to change, you know, and we do it and we make that change. And then like, well, that's not high enough. I was like, well, that might've been what's hurting you, you know? So like, what happens out there with the ball, you know, that's obviously it's being created by what's happening at impact and then launch. And so if you're wanting something to happen out there different with the golf ball and see increased performance, if I'm making some change on the equipment and the setup, there's going to be probably a change in what you're visually seeing with the ball flight. And that can be a tough thing to overcome for a lot of players. And I get it. Because it's their, you know, especially with like tour players, it's their living, you know, it's their comfort level. They have to be comfortable and confident with something going into it. You know, like one of the examples I tell a lot of people of, you know, is with Scott Stallings, who had a great week this week. He's been working so hard and the putting is really, has always kind of, you know, been his bugaboo, and he's taken some approaches, you know, he's used name point now. It was just a great weekend to see him kind of really all the hard work, cause he's been working his butt off on a lot of that stuff. But one of the things we found with Scott is that, and he's known this for a long time, his numbers, I think is, you know, things work really well. He's the type of guy that needs to be able to see loft on the driver. You take loft off the drive. And so he sees loft on the driver and then he hits down on it a little bit. What we've been able to kind of know, and he knows, is like, if he doesn't see enough loft, he starts to try to hit up on it. Mm. And he has a real difficult time with control of the golf ball. So it's one of those things. It's like, you know, so can I look at his numbers with his driver set up and say they're not optimal distance wise? I could possibly say that, but he doesn't hit it short. The great thing is, I think in the setup that he's got equipment wise right now, he's able to kind of, he drives it really well. He's driving it really well. And then when he drives it well, he putts decent. He has weekends like he had. That's one of those things. So if I were to just kind of stare at his numbers without realizing some of the player history, you know, and what works for him, could steer him down a road that would be bad. So, I mean, I've had conversations. I've said, hey, you know, this is what we're seeing ball flight wise. This is what you would see different if we made some changes. You might not like that.
Yeah.
And he just might not, but we just know that it doesn't work well when we go to that lower launch, you know, higher attack angle type stuff. So, but then as you got more of a developing golfer, you know, anytime you get them to hit it further, they're like, great.
That was great. Yeah. Thanks.
Hey, I don't care if the ball flight changes. It's going further. Cool. Let me take it and run.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a few fittings over the years where the person doesn't know what I'm trying to do beforehand. And frankly, doesn't ask the question, what I'm trying to do beforehand, but they'll see me hit irons, which are all moon balls, because that's how I deliver the club with an iron. But with a driver, I don't hit it high. I don't want that. I want the opposite, not low, but you know, mid launch. And they'll see the first part, the iron part, and they'll assume there's something wrong because the driver part doesn't match. It doesn't mm-hmm. look like it at all. And they go, well, we want to get you in something a little bit higher launching, and they'll try to manipulate to get that launch. And I'll go, I don't want any part of this. I want this to be itself, and I want that to be over there. And I don't want them to look like each other at all, because that's just not me. And then usually it works out. Then they go, okay, you're weird with a driver, and you're weird with irons, and they're two separate weird problems. So you should, let's solve this one appropriately. And then we'll basically just throw you in a stock stiff shaft for an iron, and we'll call it a day. I mean, I've never had an iron fitting where it's like, well, we should get you in these exotic iron shafts. More like, well, here's some dynamic gold S100s. See ya. And that's it. Versus the driver is like, okay, well, I've learned enough about myself to go, okay, I would like a lower gram X flex. And then let's dial down the torque and get it to launch low. I don't want a mid launch. I want a low launch. I'm an extension guy. That's all my swing is about with the driver's extension. So let's make that happen. But if the person doesn't know it beforehand, we're wasting like 30, 45 minutes talking about something I really don't want to do.
Yeah.
And I think that part of that is a function of knowing yourself. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm sure Scott Stallings is a way different level than me, but he knows himself versus how many people come in, and not that it's bad that you don't know yourself because maybe you're open to new ideas, but how many people come in and really don't know themselves?
Yeah. A lot. I mean, ask any fitter or coach, you know, so you ask them, well, how far do you hit your six iron? Well, 170. And you're just watching it go 130, 130, 130. You're like, well, okay, you know, and that's one of the big points I'll clear up with people when I'm going, because I focus in on like carry and landing angle are the two big numbers, you know, result numbers that I'm looking at. And so when I tell someone, hey, you know, 150 yards, 5 yards carry, 47 land angle, they're like, well, I normally hit this thing about 165. I said, well, yeah, are you thinking total number? And most golfers are going to think total.
Yep.
You know, and so then trying to explain to them, okay, you know, no, I operate off carry, because carry will vary day to day, but not, maybe not as much as total, you know, shot to shot. So, so I'm sitting here in my new bay, which we're getting real close to being done. I'm waiting on my roll up garage door, and you can see I've got a couple things in here right now, but, Scott Hamilton's bay and Bill Hassel's bay, they've got the PGA and LPGA tour averages off TrackMan data to say, okay, what are these top players in the world, where are they carrying it, you know, and whatnot, and what are some of the numbers that they're looking at off there? It's usually kind of surprising to show them like the actual carry numbers of your PGA tour average, like seven iron, I think it's 172 yards. You know, a lot of people wouldn't think it's further than that, I think, at times.
Yeah.
And then, you know, again, how it's created. So, you know, one of the ones that really gets a lot of people is when we actually pull that data up and we show them the apex of the golf ball, how out of PGA and LPGA tour players, on all full swings with every club, the apex is the same height. You know, PGA Tour pros, 90 feet in the air. It's on every full swing. It doesn't look that way because the wedge is so much closer to them.
The apex is closer to you, yeah.
Yeah, it's a parallax issue. So the drivers, you know, it's happening way the hell out there. So, but, you know, Cameron Champ hits every full swing 130 feet in the air. With driver, that's happening 225 yards away from him, where that peak is actually happening. You know, the wedge, it's obviously a lot closer. So they look a lot different. So then obviously, you know, getting people to think, you know, even just think about that part of it, and then how the landing angles do slightly change depending on what club you're working at. So there's always a lot that, and those are the conversations I really like having and helping people start to understand some of that about, you know, how does that affect their performance? So why is landing angle so important to me on an iron? Well, if you're a competitive golfer, you know, you have too low of a landing angle, you reduce, you know, the flags you can go after.
And your landing area, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's if you have too low a landing angle, well, guess what? You better get good at chipping from over the green because the ball's going to run through quite a bit. So, just always trying to work toward helping people understand, like, what is a functional golf shot? You know, that's a big part of it.
All right, I'm going to use this as a transition a little bit, creating functional golf shots to the PGA Championship this week with Kiawah Island. Obviously, if you know anything about the ocean course, there are 10 holes on the ocean, the most number of holes on the ocean in North America. So that's something Pete and Alice and I did on purpose 30 years ago when they built this thing. And it hosts the second PGA Championship this week. The expectation is that there's going to be plenty of wind being on the ocean. That seems reasonable. But the wind at Kiawah doesn't seem to have a prevalence. There's no prevalence. It just seems to be whatever the day brings is what it is. And that could change throughout the day. So these guys are going to be playing a 7,876-yard tipped-out course. And they might not get there. They might get 50 yards short of that. But effectively 7,800 yards. And probably more than half the holes are going to play into the wind versus downwind. So it might be an effective distance of closer to 8,000 yards than the 7,800 number. Also kind of scary to think about. But when we were talking a little bit heading into this about trying to explain to golfers the difference between playing into the wind and how much impact that has on you and your golf ball versus playing downwind and how much impact that has on not only distance but dispersion. So let's get that out of the way first, set a baseline for people. What is the expectation you should have playing into the wind versus downwind in terms of how you will perform?
Yeah, you know, this is where a lot of what the data that TrackMan has been able to create, you know, collect to confirm a lot of theories on different things. There are so many rabbit holes on this because you can apply some of this discussion to elevation, you know, differences in elevation, so like a lot of us grow up and you think about, hey, it's a 2-club wind. I'll admit there's been, Andrew Rice has talked about this a lot. Marty Jurtson from Ping actually has like a spreadsheet that he's going to be using this week. He used it in last fall for the PGA last fall. Like if the wind is this and it's with or against, it changes things. So into the wind is way more damaging than downwind is helping. You know, that's the biggest thing. And how much, it varies on what club you're hitting, how hard is the wind. So TrackMan on trackmanuniversity.com, they've actually got a little thing in there, part of one of the learning modules is, you know, well, course conditions and weather. And so you can kind of go in and play a little bit with it, you know, and say, okay, I've got a 10 mile an hour wind in my face. I've got a 6-iron in my hand. What is it down? How does that change versus downwind? So being able to understand, that starts to affect carry. But then also tying into my favorite number, how does that start to affect land angle? You know, so how do you start to approach that? You know, okay, targeting, where are you trying to land the golf ball? You know, where are you trying to get the ball to end up at? It's And then a really complicated thing. It's not linear. What happens, with a six iron is different. How much it's hurt or changes is different with a wedge and a driver. What we know from changes in elevation, the percentage of change that a golf shot is affected by elevation, it's a bell curve. It's not linear. So the middle part of the bag is affected the most. That's the top of the bell. So let's say, and I can't say exact numbers, but let's say at some elevation, six iron is affected by 10%. You get 10% more. Well, maybe it's only 6% with a driver and 6% with a wedge. So that would apply to roughly that bell curve. I think actually it kind of applies to any atmospheric condition. So, there's so many variables that go into it. A lot of people are starting to apply that and figure out ways, how can they take it to the golf course in a certain way. I just remember seeing it last fall. Marty Jurson had this really cool Excel spreadsheet that he had his numbers in that adjusted for elevation where they're playing. They adjusted for the temperature they're playing at Harding Park, adjusted for wind. What would it be at this time of day on this temp? It was impressive.
That's awesome.
But it was something that he basically had it boiled down to. I think he had it in his yardage book.
So this is, we could go down so many paths on this, but we'll just go down a couple. So obviously there's always talk about into the fan, downwind, differences there. Is there a difference between right to left and left to right wind for a golfer? Because they might hit a draw or a fade. They talk a lot about trying to control, hit it into and play with the wind versus ride it. How much does that affect it? And what's the better idea for the long haul for dispersion?
Riding the wind versus going downwind or into the wind. That's a great question. You're probably going to keep me up at night for that one now, because I'm going to have to look a little bit more into it. But the interesting thing on that is, I was a little amazed when I talked to the guys from TrackMan as to how, in a crosswind, how quickly does the spin axis of the golf ball get impacted by a crosswind, and at what level or what speed of wind actually starts to throw off the spin axis of the golf ball. And I was surprised with how it was only about 15 miles an hour of wind that you can start to see some of that. One of the other things, going back to one of your questions earlier about some things that golfers, when they come in, aren't quite understanding what's the cause of some of it. So in general, if you got a calm day, a lot of people don't quite realize curvature up to the apex pretty much created by the golfer and their launch conditions. Anything that happens after the apex is conditionals. Once the golf ball has lost its steam and it's starting to fall back down to the ground, it's 100% what's happening conditions wise. So you can hit a draw, ball left or right wind, you start a draw, hit a draw to hold it, up to its apex, it's going to get pushed right. And it's nothing to do with the player. They could literally do, once it's reached its apex and it's coming down, anything that the golfer has really done is no longer applicable. Will a left or right wind, you hit a fade, is it going to be impacted more by the left or right wind? Obviously, yeah, I think so, because now you got a bunch of things working that way. So what is the more effective strategy? And how do you pick it? That could be that's so situational. It's where's the danger on the golf shot? Right.
Where's the problem? Yeah.
Is it short? Where, if you're going to miss, where is it going to go? So do you want to, that's very, very situational, I think. So what could create the greatest dispersion? And I don't know, that all of a sudden I think can come back down. Obviously, what's the player's, stronger suit as far as shot shape? Are they more of a draw bias golfer, fade bias golfer? How can they manage some of that? But obviously, that can evolve over time. So So it's one of those questions. It's a super interesting one to think about. And then, you know, like so many of my instructor friends will, you know, the first words out of their mouth will be, it depends.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
And the other thing I thought about based on just the initial discussion was there's always talk about keeping it under the wind. And I find that such a silly discussion because wind is everywhere all the time. It's not like there's the first 10 feet, no wind, and then the next 10 feet, a lot of wind. It's not like it that. So can you keep it under the wind? Or is that just kind of a myth?
You know, I think in it, again, another interesting one I'd have to think and see some of it. So obviously the longer the ball is in the air, the more spin, there's more spin has come off the golf ball. So it also has lost some ball speed as well. Then it might be in a situation where it's going to fluttering and floating a little bit more. So does keeping the ball under the wind technically mean maybe the ball is in the air for one less second? That can be a huge one. That could be a part of it. Because now not only is the ball, the big thing is it's just not in the air as long. So it's down a little bit lower under the wind. Just it's had less time to be affected by the wind, and it's, the spin rate may be holding it with the wind a little bit better. You're just kind of, again, trying to give yourself a little bit of a margin toward being able to fight some of that. And it's funny you bring that up because I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with one of the reps from Titleist on the PGA Tour because Scott Hamilton had gotten some golf balls in here and I'd never seen one of them before. It was Pro V1 Star, which is a PGA Tour only ball. I hope I'm not hurting anybody, but I don't think so. But people have seen it because I've seen it mentioned in, like what's in the bag stuff. But yeah. It's a PGA Tour only ball. It's a lower launch ball that they figured out how to have it not degrade spin wise as much as a normal ball. Typical degradation of spin is about 3.3% for every second it's in the air. They've got something figured out cover wise or something that allows that to not happen at as much of a rate. How much is it different? I don't know. But the idea is that, it launches lower and it maintains its spin further out. Which is kind of funny because we kind of knew that that's what an old TrackMan actually, I talked to Frederick on this once. He said, the construction of the old Bellotta golf ball actually allowed that to happen because of the wound cover cover with a wound core around a solid core. But essentially those rubber bands, even though they're pulled real tight, when you hit it, there was still a little bit of the cover twisting against those. And then all of a sudden, the core would react and it would actually add spin a little bit away from impact versus with a modern, modern multi-piece solid core ball, it's losing spin immediately.
Right.
The old Bellotta would actually, a little spin would actually come back onto the ball after impact. Just because the outside is turning where the inside is kind of saying
fractionally. Like a little resistance onto itself, almost spin and spin.
Yeah. If you look like a dragster.
Yeah.
You look at how the inner part of the wheel spins, the outer part of the wheel doesn't, but it's the exact opposite, I guess, with the golf ball.
Right.
Similar, but that visual. So this ball. And so, what this guy was telling me is as soon as they move to a different part of the country and they're looking at different things, all of a sudden the guys start wanting a different golf ball. They move away from, the West Coast, where it's, usually a little bit softer and they want to maybe not as much wind issue. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they move into Texas, and it's, firmer conditions, windier. They want to keep it down out of the wind. So, some of the guys want to start experimenting with a little bit lower launching golf ball. It's interesting, that plays into it. So I bet there'd be some guys, if it is howling out at Kiowa, maybe there's some guys switching balls because of that.
Well, I think the net result of a discussion that could probably be 2 hours is, one, it depends, is a big answer. And two, it's a huge puzzle these guys are going to have to figure out. And I'm not certain that the person who wins that the best is going to win the championship, but it probably is going to go a long way in determining who will.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could sit there and, you know, and say, well, you know, maybe some people make little changes like this and it increases their chances of doing it. Then you look at Tiger, and, man, that dude didn't change much at all, ever. He just took what he did, learned how to, you know, when he was at his peaks, you know, he just put what he did out there, even if it wasn't, quote, unquote, optimal. As it comes down to it, you know, if it is Howland, and like any kind of tour event for the most part, it's going to be who's kind of managing their game well enough to where they can seize an opportunity over a 9-hole stretch to maybe separate themselves out. And, you know, just kind of, again, put themselves in the position. It's funny how, you know, I'm a big racing fan. So I love NASCAR and things like that. And, you know, this is it's interesting. Some of the discussions I hear in NASCAR about, like, if you ask someone, like, what's a good race, you know, you're going to get a lot of different answers on that. But then, you know, some people think a lot of side-by-side racing, you know, really just, you know, bumping and banging down the end. That's good racing. And then, you know, like the last few weeks, it's really one or two drivers have kind of dominated the races. To me, I still think that's good racing because that's someone really getting the setup and really getting their, you know, what they do right. So to me is a, you know, a major championship where there's a lot of guys in contention coming down on the back nine, really exciting. Yeah. 2019 Masters. Awesome. You know, great. Are blowouts equally cool to me? Yeah. I don't mind. I don't think either one of them is good or bad. So very similar things to the racing world, honestly.
Well, I don't know what we're going to get. Last time we got an 8-shot win for Rory McIlroy. I don't know if that kind of blowout's coming here again, but like you, I am of the belief that as long as I'm very agnostic on what is a good golf tournament. So long as it's not boring with 9 to go, whether it's someone doing something you're never going to see again or 6 guys with a chance to win that you don't know who's going to win until the very last putt drops. I think, I
mean, if I remember correctly, I think did Kiewit play a little soft when he won that by 8? Was it
a little? And then there was some rain on Saturday. Yeah. And then McIlroy finished his third round on Sunday, but he shot 75 in the second round. And then on the weekend was like untouchable.
Yeah.
And that was, I think he started the final round with maybe a 2-shot lead and wound up winning by 8. So it's thought of as a blowout, but going to the final round, it was anything but. I mean, there were a lot of players that could have put some pressure on him.
Cause I don't know. I haven't really checked to see what the forecast is over there, but this week is going to, by the end of the week, it's going to be 90 here again. So, and we've had a lot of crappy weather the last few weeks, a lot of storms, but this is like a solid week of heat and dry. So, I mean, if that equates over to firm, fast and windy over there, I'll be even more interested to tune in because that's my favorite stuff to watch.
Yeah. It's going to feel like a hot British Open if it's like, and I'm all for that because that means on a Pete Dye course where you got to carry a whole lot of stuff too, you're going to have to play in the air and down below to get it to run out. And that'll make you use everything you got.
Yeah, buddy. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that's this edition of Gear Effects. We thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the discussion. If you do, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, Spotify, however they do it. And you can watch us on Golf News Net, also on our Golf News Net TV channels for Amazon, Fire, Apple TV, and Roku TV, as well our YouTube channel at Golf News Net. For Pete Weber, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thank you for watching or listening. We'll talk to you next time on Gear Effects.
Have a great week, everyone.